and welcome to Two Words Wolves Pod. My name is Ryan Eichten, and with me today is Dane Moore. Dane, how you doing?
Good, man. I'm glad we waited for the right time to do this. I feel like it's here. It's the season's here. I'm ready.
Yeah, I mean, we finally got some stuff to talk about. Had media day on Monday. Before that, I'm not sure you and I both doing pods, just kind of making up topics as we go, but they gave us some content to work with, right?
They did. Now it's time to go. It was, well, because there was no moves in the off season, really, you know? Yeah. Like, normally you can get something, you know, July, August, but it got real dry. But I don't know. That's right, kind of like representative of where this team is at, you know, kind of running it back, not making big changes.
Yeah, for better or for worse, I guess. depends how you look at it. But before we jump into, I have a list of just kind of biggest questions heading into the season that I've been just picking out whichever ones I feel like it with each guest that's come on. But before we do that, I just wanted to get your preliminary kind of takeaways from both media days, which I was at as well, but then as well as the first couple of days of training camp, which I was not able to attend. Any big major thoughts from the first 3 days of media availabilities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of the vibe of when you're just in the middle of the season and you're coming in and it's kind of business as usual, and you get in there and they do their interviews and they're out and it's nothing big or dynamic or anything like that. And the first 2 days of training camp, I feel like for that too, is very dialed in group. And then media day, it just, there wasn't any drama, you know, this year surrounding it. There's been all sorts of stuff for, you know, I asked Ant about this yesterday at practice. It's just like, you know, how does this feel? It's not just last season that there was something big happening around this time of year, but really of every year of Anthony Edwards' first 5 years, there was always something sort of surrounding extra drama or just, you know, or just the trade stuff that got in the way of being able to hit the ground running in training camp. And Ant was like, yeah, it feels different that way. It feels business as usual. So it's what it feels like to me being there, but I think the players and the coaches echo that.
Yeah, just they seem confident in what they're going to try to do this season, where last year, basically because of the trade or because of whatever else, I don't think the confidence was there, or at least they hadn't, like, they made the trade they needed to make, but it shook them to their core in the sense of everyone that was there. I don't think Ant was ready to step into that leadership role necessarily, or at least not at the beginning of the season, where this year it felt like he was ready. He's now ready. And I bet you, even regardless of the Cat trade, I bet you that would have happened around this time, where it's just like, I think he's ready to step into that 1A leadership. I'm the superstar. I'm the planets, the universe revolves around me. Where he wasn't really that, maybe 12 months ago.
Yeah, I think the Cat trade, like, sped that up. Sure. You talk about Ant not being ready for it last year. I would agree with that, but it's because he went to training. He went the whole summer and showed up for media day, not thinking he was going to be that. And I think Ant, you know, the 12, 24 months ago version of him was very conscientious of allowing that to be cast too, you know, to give him the credit of being the guy who'd been on the team forever and had been an all NBA player, all those sort of things. And they kind of 1A, 1B'd it. I again remember asking Ant about it at media day last year, like, you know, what does this feel like now? You are like the dude. And he said, he's like, I don't know how to feel about that yet. To your point, I think he knows how to feel about it now. And I think it could be a positive externality of the Cat trade is you got this version of Ant sooner. I'm not sure I agree that if the Julius and Dante for Cat trade happens, that Ant is at this place from a leadership standpoint, because he was just shoved into the deep end with it last year.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think one of the biggest reasons he wasn't necessarily like the biggest leader was just his natural personality of supporting others. And I think that came through with Cat, because one national narrative that I think didn't fit the local narrative was that Cat and Ant were going to butt heads in terms of who's this team's going to be, quote unquote. And I don't really, at least from my perspective, that was never really, I always thought Cat was going to be willing to, at least, especially on the court, like just play his role. But where
they were going to be non-confrontational with that, like it might have got to a point where they would have, I don't know, Conley or mm-hmm. Finch or something would have had to come in and be like, hey, you know, we need Ant to, you know, to assert himself. But those guys were cool personally, as you know, and I think Ant didn't want to step on, and I think that was smart with the knowing Cat and knowing what the roster was. Like that, I liked the way that Ant moved through that early on in his career. I don't think a lot of number one overall picks on the trajectory that he was on would have, would have played that so kind of socially aware as he did.
For sure. And I think, like, on the court, Ant obviously became the quote-unquote best player, the number one player in Cat's last season here. But in locker room-wise, leadership-wise, or just maybe announced last at Target Center at home games-wise, Cat was still that guy. And that it came both ways, where it was like Cat on the court never needed more than his role, and Ant was willing to let Cat, not let Cat, that's poor phrasing, but like he didn't mind that Cat was still the mm-hmm. quote-unquote franchise player, whatever that means. And it, like you mentioned, it was probably a positive happenstance that they got to throw Ant mm-hmm. into the deep end of because like if Cat got paid half the money, he'd still be here. I'm fairly confident in that. Maybe I'm wrong.
Definitely, like, a big factor.
Yeah. But I bet you it wasn't necessarily like, well, let's trade Cat so Ant becomes the leader. I don't think that was necessarily part of their thinking with the trade, but you kind of get lucky that's what happens.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. No, I co-sign that 100%.
Awesome. Let's head into our biggest questions. First player that I haven't talked about much during the preseason has been Julius Randle, who had an up and down season last year, and probably the biggest thing from they've said it at media day, they really said it, I think, at exit interviews too, both Julius and the Tim Connelly and French and whoever else, was just that they were him and Dante especially were just unsettled in their lives, their personal lives. Julius probably dating back to his injury in New York. I don't think with the fan base, with the organization, he never really, his life kind of derailed from there, his professional life kind of derailed from there. And it took until his injury, both him and Dante's injury, I think, obviously John Krasinski had a great piece I would recommend everyone reading about Julius, but it took him until getting injured and like just sitting down, getting his personal life in order, his wherever he was living. In John's piece, he said they were renting an apartment until they bought a house this offseason, and they really took until this extension to really know that he was going to be here. I know plenty of talk in the media room after games, like, I wonder what they're going to trade Julius Randle for, or they really need to start Naz Reid, right? And it all clicked in down the stretch of the season, but, I mean, just in the aggregate, he had a quote-unquote down season. So my question for you is, can Julius Randle make it back to the All-Star game, or at the very least, All-Star game form?
Yeah, we'll talk about the basketball part of it, and I want to kind of talk about it being a down year there. Obviously, the John piece you talked about, and that highlights so much of Julius's kind of mental state over the last 24, 36 months, maybe going back to New York. And then we talk about the groin injury in January as a turning point for him of last season to where he really took off those final 21 games. I think we missed a big variable in another injury, which was at this time last year when the Wolves traded for Julius Randle, he was not healthy. He was still recovering from a shoulder injury that kept him out of all but the final preseason game. And even then, you know, I'm sure he was healthy enough to be playing for, it was a preseason game, but I think it's fair to note that he was not 100% of himself or fully, just fully like acclimated with his body. And also, like, what's a huge part of Julius Randle's game? Like getting downhill, burying his defender like with his shoulder so as to go finish or, you know, spray it out for a kick. Like, it's having a serious like labrum issue was a serious issue, I think, for Julius's game last season. And that amongst the trade and the now acclimating to new teammates and stuff, I'm surprised kind of in hindsight that he wasn't worse at the beginning of the year. Remember, actually, the beginning of the year was kind of like that second game in Sacramento. He was really good. There was at least like spots of good Julius early on, and but there was also discomfort, and he just didn't. He certainly didn't seem like the Julius Randle that we saw, you know, the end of the season and the first two rounds of the playoffs. And I think that's all worth noting in the arc of this story. And I think takes away a little bit from the, okay, well, in the aggregate, it was a down season, you know, as a catch-all metric or an 82 game thing would acknowledge. That said, I'm not like certain that it's going to be the production that he had, you know, the last 21 games of the season. But I don't know. I feel like I've come a long way from those conversations that maybe you and I were having in the media room in November, December of last season of like, all right, well, what something's got to happen here. What could they do to make it? I'm way more in the mind of like, oh, I'm seeing paths to how to make it work on the floor, in the cap sheet, personalities wise with Julius. It's a huge stock up for me in my analysis of this team.
Yeah, and one thing I looked into was just his flat numbers, and obviously they're down. But I was looking at his efficiency stuff, and he had the best, most efficient season of his career, and that's probably going to naturally happen when you lower your volume a little bit. But like, his scoring was down from to 18.7 per game, and his positive or his best seasons in New York were 24-25 a game. But 2-point scoring efficiency up. 3-point scoring efficiency, not the highest of his career, but a fairly solid number. And the turnovers were down again, maybe due to just volume. So like, I guess my question would be like, to make the All-Star game in the West, he's probably going to have to get back to 24 a game. And other than shooting, just having some weird variance, 45% 3-point shooting year, you're going to have to increase volume to get him back up to that number. And I guess my question would be like, should that even be something they are looking for him to do? Or was the volume and the touches he had last year, maybe specifically down the stretch of the last season in the playoffs, is that the numbers, is that the type of volume they should be looking for from him? Because if so, at least my original question of the All-Star game is probably not going to happen, mostly because the strength of just the pure strength of the Western Conference talent wise.
Well, I think you've done more research than I have on kind of what the statistical thresholds are for the All-Star game, but I pulled up some random numbers that I had in my notes from a previous episode I did. Final 21 games of the regular season. After he comes back from that injury, Wolves go 17-4, and Julius Randle averages 18-7-5 in that time while shooting 40% from three and 59% from two. And I note that, like, obviously that 40% pops, right? And frankly, I'm not really a believer that over the scope of a season, Julius Randle is going to be a 40% three-point shooter. But in those 21 games, he did it while shooting 59% from two, which is extremely efficient from two, given what we know what his shot profile is, in addition to, you know, to the playmaking that he does there. Are those numbers All-Star numbers?
I don't think so, but if the Wolves have the best record in the Western Conference at the break, it probably is.
Right. I would agree with all of that. I think it's in the whole Julius Randle All-Star conversation, I think, is actually more so about his the team's record and their placing in there rather than his individual, you know, sort of metrics. I think if Julius Randle makes the All-Star team, it's because he's the second guy who makes the All-Star team in addition to Anthony Edwards from one of the best teams in the Western Conference. Like, I think that would be the story that you tell yourself. But maybe 18-7-5 even on good efficiency isn't that. So you move to the first two rounds of the playoffs, And against the Lakers and the Warriors. And Julius Randle averages 24, 6, and 6 on 35% shooting from three, but again, 59% shooting from two. And I think that those percentages are probably more realistic. Again, that 59% from two is really high. But I, you know, he shot 59%. It is less, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's probably the number I'd pick for him.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. Again, if we're doing like over under on what Julius Randle shoots from three this season, I am probably taking the under on 37.5, you know, maybe probably the over on 35. But like, yeah, sure. more in that range. But Julius has done it before, where he shot 40% from three. And I really think that's the game breaker of the seasons that made him, you know, an Eastern Conference All-Star. I think if you look at his all NBA seasons, that at least one of them is a 40% from three year. I think if you do get that higher end outcome from him, which is what we're talking about with the All-Star game, I'm saying he is exceeding our expectations to some extent. I just think that's the way he exceeds it from an offensive standpoint. He's a force underneath from 2-point range, getting deeper, not taking a bunch of mid-range shots. That's where that dipped in New York when you're taking 16 footers. So if he's getting down to 8-9 feet and scoring in that 2-point range at 59, I can see that. I know I can see the playmaking element of it. I do think the 6 or 7 assists is very, very much on the table. But yeah, I think to really be reductive about it, I think it's probably got to shoot close to 40%, and the scoring numbers per points per game probably need to be closer to that 24 points per game in the playoffs, first two rounds of the playoffs, than it was the 18-7-5, the final 21 games of the regular season. I do think he was a little bit of a passive scorer in that time. He was looking to playmake a little bit more there. So I don't know. Is it, if we average the two, what is that? That'd be 21, like 6-6. 21, 6-6, and if he's doing it on close to 40% from three and 59% from two, I don't know. I think that's an all-star if the Wolves are top two or three seed in the West.
Yeah, I agree. And I just looked up Jalen Williams' stats, which kind of he would probably fall into. Sure. Like at the break, they're like, well, Oklahoma City's running away with the West. They need a second all-star. He had 21.6 points, 5.1 assists, 5.3 rebounds, looking just shooting percentages, 53 from two, 36 from three. And just from the numbers you laid out with Randle, all of those numbers seem doable. So and even to your three-point shooting point, I don't think a 40% three-point shooting full season is possible. Is a 40% three-point shooting first half or second half possible?
Sure.
I think so. Yeah. Like
that's like, what the grading is. Yeah, it doesn't need to be 82 games.
Right, and it's like, well, if he shoots 37.5 on the season, and one first half is 40% and the other is 35%, like that's that's how you'd get there.
I'm just saying it's in the realm of possibilities. I'm saying it's in the realm. Sure. Like, what would you think the gambling odds on Julius making the All-Star team? Or like, what would you set, not the gambling odds, what would you set the percentage chance that he makes it? 20? Ooh,
that's tough.
20% chance?
I first thought 10%, and I thought that's too low. 20% is probably the number. I was looking at last year's All-Star team, and just two guys, Jaren Jackson, and there was one other player. I'm off the top of my head, I was like, well, Julius could easily fit into that spot. Not to, like, we're not comparing those two players necessarily, but certainly on a similar level. Because there's 10 All-Stars. It's just like, okay, those guys, if they're healthy, they're gonna slide immediately into the All-Star game above Julius Randle. So you got like two or three spots you're fighting for like with a dozen guys. So it's, I think your point
and
that
injuries, like what you know, what else is going on around the league.
Yeah, and if he was in the Eastern Conference, that 20%, I bet, would be like 80%, especially with you're already, Tatum and Halliburton are already two open spots for you. And I guess in the West, Fred VanVleet opens up as like one of those guys that, like, he could have been Houston's second All-Star, maybe. And unfortunately, someone else will unfortunately get hurt, and you hope it's not your team. But I guess just how much do you think feeling settled and just all the bullshit from the trade deadline and the hangover from New York, how much do you think is just going to, like, I don't necessarily agree with it, but there's this feeling that the last 21 games where they went 17-4 were a bit of a mirage. Certainly,
sure.
I would point to one thing I pointed to is even just sitting there at the end of March or beginning of March being like, their schedule is really easy. They might just, if they just play how they were playing, they were going to win a bunch of games. And so I would, but if you're going to say that, you can also point to, well, maybe part of the reason they struggled early in the season is because the schedule was hard. But how much do you, do you think the end of the season and the playoffs were real from Julius? And to what extent was that just fueled by all the crap was to the side?
Yeah, I mean, it was weak, like the competition in the final 21 games of the season in just like kind of luck of the draw of playing some lesser teams or getting the, like, I think they'd already played Oklahoma City like four times prior to that.
Yeah, they did it in the span of, they played three of the four games like in a row with the All-Star break in between. It was stupid. And the Wolves were so hurt that entire, like Randall,
right.
I think Randall and Gobert, and they played the Thunder once the entire season.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, it was a lesser schedule. And then you can point to like the Lakers and Warriors not being, you know, optimal versions of themselves. Obviously they weren't. Steph was hurt and stuff like that. But again, in the aggregate of those final 21 games of the season where they went 17-4, and then the 10 games against, 5 against the Lakers, 5 against the Warriors, you know, that's a 31 game sample size. And overall, if you look at the overall talent of all of that, that's still probably like mediocre, because you're getting, you know, playoff version of the Lakers and playoff version of the Warriors, even in first. Like, I don't know. It's kind of like a regular season caliber of opponent, a median sort of level of that. I don't know. Like, it's not strong, but it also meets like other, I think, lines of logic of getting more comfortable. Finch finally sort of like establishing to Julius's teammates that were playing through Julius, like a huge part of belief in Julius is tied to being to Finch, you know, like Finch is going to give Julius Randle the opportunity to have an all-star season. We know that. You could disagree with it, but he's going to get that type of usage, that type of direction in the offense. He's going to be protected when he struggles. Like, it is, I don't know. If there's any coach that can make Julius Randle an all-star, it's Chris Finch.
Yeah. And, I mean, going back to the time in New Orleans, that's where kind of he rejuvenated his career from his time in L.A. He was kind of trending towards bust. And when Finch was his assistant coach in New Orleans, those guys have a great relationship. And especially, I think, last year, that was something a lot of especially you guys that are there every single day, you guys were pointing out. It's just like, I'm not necessarily like agreeing with, agreeing with it necessarily, but like they love Julius Randle. So at a certain point, you either have to, I don't know, if you're a fan and that's something you can't deal with, you either got to ignore it or I don't know. That's the reality. And it's just
to
like
each your own, like do whatever you got to do. You know, my goal in all of this is like, yeah, I'm trying to give some analysis of myself, but my primary thing is to be like, because I think it's really informative as a fan to like know what they're thinking internally. And that was a great example of a thing with what they were thinking internally so greatly deviated from the external perception of it. And I think another thing like that's happening right now is synonymous is the Rob Dillingham and Mike Conley. And it's just like, you can tell that they're going to lean towards Mike Conley more than I think public perception or appetite is, you know, it might be asking for. It's you can have that opinion. You might be proven right about the opinion, but let's remember that you were proven wrong about the Julius Randle opinion, because it was better than we all thought, you know, hand raised, you too, about, you know, back in November, December. So I don't know. It comes down to like, do you believe in Finch? Mm-hmm. That's a huge thing with this whole team.
Yeah,
because it's built
for sure,
in his image.
Absolutely. But this is why you're a pro, Dane, because my next topic is Rob Dillingham. Rob is a player that I just have no feel on what they're going to get from him in the short term, in the long term. I am just kind of confused on it. The top end and the bottom end are so wide on his career, on his season next year. I'm not sure what to believe. I know, like, they're like hand raised. I didn't like the trade basically from the first night. I'm admittedly very conservative about sending away picks. I had the same knee jerk when they traded for Rudy. And I was proven wrong with Rudy, but, it's not that I don't care what the picks end up. They haven't really given the Jazz much. Walker Kessler is probably the best asset and they're struggling to find an extension for him. But it's just like, personally, I think the Wolves are like one move away. And so it's like that pick that they sent out for Rob, if in fact doesn't work out, like the opportunity cost is gone. But ultimately, that doesn't matter anymore because you got him on your roster. So I guess just
Can I jump in on the asset piece real quick, too? Because I think it's an important part of the story, I think, too. A couple things related to it. One, they drafted Rob Dillingham before they made the Julius Randle and Dante DiVincenzo trade. They drafted him 3 months before that, you know? Yep. That's important context because Rob Dillingham was drafted in the image of a different roster construction. One that did not specifically have like Dante DiVincenzo on it, which then thus created a greater need for a combo guard like Rob Dillingham. That's an important piece of it, which I think devalued the move of trading up to get Rob Dillingham, where they traded a 2031 unprotected first, right? That's what it is.
Yeah, and a 2030 swap. Yep.
Yeah, and so what the comparison I was going to do is that was kind of like the Michael Porter Cam Johnson trade, right? 2032. Sure. It was a year later, 7 years out.
Same value. Yep.
Yeah, but to your one move away point, which I would argue maybe the Denver Nuggets are or were prior to doing that, they were able to use the power of that 7 years out unprotected pick to, I think, seriously upgrade their roster, because it wasn't just Cam Johnson for Michael Porter Jr. It was, I think Cam Johnson makes like 14, 15 million less than Porter Jr. does. So now they got 14, 15 million more in flexibility to go get a Tim Hardaway Jr., a Bruce Brown, a Jonas Valanciunas, those sort of things. That's the alternative path, theoretically, right? For the Wolves, is you don't make this Dillingham move, you have that asset that you could, you know, similarly make a move like the Nuggets did. So I think that is an all important pretext of analyzing the Rob Dillingham thing. Now let's talk about the basketball. What you said off the top is it's really hard to have a great idea of what his impact could potentially be as a basketball player.
Yeah, and it's going to be, because of the asset stuff, it becomes more important than if him and Berenger weren't drafted that far apart in terms of draft capital, a total of, I mean, it's a good value gap between what, 8 and 14 or 6, whatever it ended up being. Mm-hmm. But like, if Berenger, I think we'll kind of touch on it at the end of the pod, but like, if Berenger kind of ends up not working out, which is in the world, like there won't be an outcry really to be like, oh, that stinks. That could have, like, right now we think he can be a solid NBA player either next year, whatever. But it's like, if Dillingham doesn't work out, it's like, that was a big swing and a miss. And you only get so many of those. I mean, the Rudy was a single double home run trade, but like it, at the very least, it shrunk your margin of error. And it's like, can you take that swing and a miss? But right. On the court, yeah. It's – go ahead.
Well, that's the thing is it's just like – I feel like myself too, like we're doing too much of the like really viewing him as potentially being a bust. And like that could happen. That happens to eighth overall picks like all the time. But I don't think we have enough evidence or context or anything to really have substantially moved our position on him 12 months ago. Like, it's so many of the things that have moved my position on Rob Dillingham are the external factors that Julius Randle and Dante DiVincenzo are on the team. Like, I mean, I'm not a big like draft scout or anything like that. I don't think when I watched Rob Dillingham play in, you know, limited minutes last season, I don't think it was awful. I think I saw at times, at least, some of the pop that I saw at Kentucky. I think everything they believed in him is still very much like in the realm of possibility. But that runs counter to the immediate, which is a team who went to the conference finals two seasons in a row that is really trying to break through that ceiling this year. Like, and it's time to do so. Rudy Gobert is 33 years old. Your young core is approaching their prime. Like, that's what, again, what we know from talking to the players and the coaches and the executives is that's the intention of this roster right now. And the reality of the situation is that's just a tough spot for a 20-year-old, especially point guard who's 165 pounds, to be able to come in and give you the type of production that's bankable, you know? Like, that's the thing with Rob is it's, I don't know, it could be good, but, like, what's bankable? What's the mean outcome of this? You know, I don't, it's so hard to say, which makes him such a fascinating piece, I think, even in preseason, to see out on the floor. Like, what does this actually look like on the floor? And then we can go to the point of like, yeah, well, maybe it's just he's not ready in year two to be a major contributor. Or maybe the alternative, maybe you're like, oh, wait, this does work. He does, you know, it's such like a blank canvas to me right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and to your, I mean, what you just described there is why I didn't like the trade in the first place, because like I feel like we could have seen that coming. But at this point, we can like yeah, that it we're sunk cost.
But what do you make about the Julius thing? What do you make about the fact that they did draft him prior to the Julius thing? You would like it was a better move to draft him then, right? When you thought Cat was on the team,
yeah.
Like that we have to factor that, right?
Right. And they, I think with what they were saying, after that draft, which they were very, like, they talked about like finding the loophole in the CBA where they could add this yeah. amount of money while being about the second apron. I think that points to the fact that they were viewing this in the terms of with Cat on the books, we just have so little movement. And we saw this offseason with Cat off
really
the books,
good point.
They had a lot of more flexibility, and they used that flexibility to run the team back, which I in general agree with their moves there. So I think you're right that the trade made more sense in the context of the Cat trade, but ultimately, like, they're the ones, like, no one forced them to make the Cat trade. So, like, I get that, like, mm-hmm. I get it. Like, it made more sense under the previous context. Like, what I think about is important is this year is, like, you have to find out. To the extent you can find out he's 20 and a half right now, he turns 21 in January, a good example of that. What were you doing at 21? What were I doing at 21? I know when I 21, I bought a six-pack and I drank it on my couch. Like, that's where I was at 21 years old. Like, I think, like you mentioned, you got to give him a little bit of leeway, but I just think you got to play him. You can't... I mean, obviously, if it's terrible, then you pull the plug, whatever. I don't anticipate that to be the case. But you just, to the extent you can figure out what a 21-year-old small guard is, you have to figure that out this year. And you have the regular season set up to do it. If he is a net negative on the court, either small or large, you that's what the continuity is for. You can handle that, still win games. Maybe you lose one, two extra over the course of the regular season because you were playing Rob 15 to 20 instead of 5 to 10. Mm-hmm. But like, just figure it out, because then whatever comes next offseason, if there is a big move to be made or not made, it you got to know what Rob Dillingham is, because Mike only has so many quality NBA seasons left. And from what I get off of social media, some people think that number is zero. So sure. I don't agree with that, but my big thing is like, figure it out, and you got to play him.
You know what I want to hammer home, which you brought up in the pretext of the Rob Dillingham story, is the second apron. If the second apron does not exist, there's no way Rob Dillingham is on this team. There's no way. Mm-hmm. It like the strategic rationale for the pick above the player was the fact that they were limited to adding that summer, last summer, 2024 summer, the only thing they could add to the team because they were in the second apron was minimum contracts. So they thought they were slick, and frankly, I thought it was pretty slick at the time too, mm-hmm. that they did, as you called it, kind of find a loophole, which was, okay, well, there's one way where we can add players that cost more than $2 million. It's the draft. So let's go do that. Let's go get a player in the draft that is likely going to be substantially more valuable than just signing a minimum contract player. You know, like we're talking about like Austin Rivers or something like that, you know? And mm-hmm. and I thought it was slick at the time, but if, you know, in the world where this doesn't work out with Rob Dillingham, that's going to be a big part of the story that I'm telling, is that mm-hmm. I don't think they would have had the chance to make this mistake, and if it ends up being a mistake, if the inception of the second apron never happens. It's just, I highly doubt that trade happens on draft night 24 if the Wolves' salary isn't as high as it is.
It's very true. How often just in NBA history do you see a team that is trying to win championships, or at the very least is trying to win as many playoff series as they can, add a young piece? They generally don't do that. You right. see the opposite. You see the pick going out the door, unless it's like with Dallas and Cooper Flagg. Obviously the Wolves would have.
The incentive structure isn't there. The incentive structure just yep. isn't there. It's that simple, right? The Wolves were in a salary cap situation where the incentive structure was in place to take that risk. I get it. I mean, I thought about it at the time, but we didn't know anything. That was the beginning, man. We had no idea. They didn't. And they would say they were figuring out and, you know, estimating what the salary cap environment would be. And again, I got why they did it, but maybe it proves to be a thing where it was an overreaction to the new salary cap environment. Or the other way, it ends up being extremely great foresight, right? If this does work with Rob Dillingham, mm-hmm. it's like, man, that was a really smart move, because the alternative would have been that this team just had a minimum contract player. It's kind of a fascinating modern NBA story, right? In roster yeah. construction in today's day and age. But on the floor, I don't know, man. Like we got to just see it. Like I don't know what to tell you. Like it's. I watched the stuff at Kentucky. He played a little bit last year. I think I see a vision for how that incorporates into the offense, and a pace and a playmaking and all that. I kind of like how he really tried on defense. But man, it's hard for me to like set a stock price on him right now until we see it.
Yeah, and I think it's, I mean, they're still in a tough salary cap spot, excuse me. Every team is they're in a certainly much better spot now with basically the three big extensions and the cat trade. But like, if they can still get a quality player at what is Rob's contract, gets up to $10 million by the end of the rookie scale, I think, like if you're still getting a quality, if he's, I mean, certainly a solid outcome would be like a sixth man type scorer type. I think certainly that'd be a positive outcome.
Right,
also within.
Mil. Yeah.
Right. That's a great value at $10 million. That's what they're paying their starting point guard this year. I'm dubious that he's going to be game one Western Conference Finals. Wolves are favored to win the title. Starting point guard Rob Dillingham. I'm a little dubious of that. Just
That's a whole other part of the conversation. You're right. Of like, what is the value of that archetype of player in the NBA in 2025, given that we've seen, you know, in the last five whatever type of years in the playoffs, that type of player not being the same value in the postseason that they are in the regular season. I think that's wise to pick up too. I do think sometimes we point to a couple guys that their value completely craters in the postseason of an archetype, and we go, this is the truth for the archetype. I don't have think about this of other, like, it's not like some small guys can't work in the playoffs either. We just, you know what I'm saying, like we sometimes yep. focus on the negative more than the full scope of outcomes there, but that's a huge factor too. Sorry, cut you off a little bit.
Yeah, but I think it's the opposite archetype that fits your bill here is Rudy. Is like, Rudy can't play in the playoffs. where it's just like, there's like, certainly his value diminishes, but like, the Wolves couldn't stop anyone when Rudy wasn't out there. And that's the ultimate. It's the, we'll do a pod 25 years from now and be like, remember when they had Rudy and they couldn't score with him on the court, and they couldn't defend anyone with him off the court? Like, it's just going to be like an endless debate, and why I kind of have fondness for the double big team, because it was like, they had two of those guys, but they're mm-hmm. they were the exact opposite, where Kat was like, well, if you have him, if Kat's your center, you're going to be a top 10 offense, but you're going to have like, you're going to have the carousel is going to be running all night.
But in 23-24, they were awesome with Rudy off the floor defensively. Which was a credit to Kat that I did not give them enough, you know, credit for that season. You know, as I'm now analyzing this a little bit more for this season, as I think the Nas minutes or the non-Rudy minutes are pretty critical this year. I've been looking at that a lot, and it worked. I wouldn't say Kat gets all the credit for that. I think he had great surrounding defensive personnel around him when Rudy was off the floor. Nikhil Alexander Walker, Kyle Anderson, both since departed, you know, like, it was Jaden in his first real breakout defensive season. Kat was really well insulated there too. And I think that's kind of the thing we need to focus on this year. I'm not sure Nas can get to that level that Kat could as an individual. But I think it's less about the individual and more about like the collective mindset of the group. And effectiveness of the defensive group when Rudy's off the floor. This sounds like a small sort of thing. Like, Dane Ryan, why are you guys like talking about what this team is going to look like with Rudy off the floor? You know, whatever. It's the regular season, and teams survived. The Wolves survived without it last year. This is a playoffs conversation, because we mm-hmm. saw in the playoffs that Finch dashed Rudy's playing time substantially. You know, not quite in half, but, you know, was 75% of it, which increases the importance of the non-Rudy minutes to this team. I mean, in a really major way, because I don't know, half the minutes in the playoffs, if it's anything like last year, will not include Rudy Gobert on the floor. So this is important. This is important to be able to play defense with Rudy off the floor.
Yeah, especially because I kind of, if Rudy... I think Rudy has a ceiling to play better in the playoffs. I mean, if you can get the game five against the Lakers once every series instead of once every playoffs, that'd be great. Or, I mean, ideally a couple times a series, like, or just a little bit more on the glass defense. Like, but ultimately, there's a good chance that, like,
opponent. What if it wasn't the Lakers and the Warriors? You know what I mean? Those teams were like uniquely suited, or by necessity, playing small, you know, like, they didn't want to play Jackson Hayes anyways, right? They, like, the mm-hmm. Warriors didn't want to play Quentin Post or Looney or anything like that. Like, they were teams who kind of preferred to go small. What if they play the Clippers in the first round last year? You know, and I think
Brook Lopez.
I don't remember the standings exactly. Yeah, so then it's Zubats, right? Like, that Rudy plays more than 24 minutes in a playoff series against the Clippers, you know? So, I mean, I absolutely take your point. I'm making the same point too.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, in the small sample size of playoff series and the randomness of opponent, that we may be exacerbating Rudy's deficiencies on playoff impact to some extent. Obviously, Rudy has a history of not being as impactful in the regular season versus playoffs. I get that. But, you know, there's the green light and there's the red light, and maybe we should look at the yellow light a little bit too, on the gradient of this thing.
Well, the first team that comes to mind that you're going to need Rudy to beat is Denver. If you got any shot of any shot of like, Jokic, obviously one-on-one he's good against Rudy, but that is far more about Jokic than it is about Gobert at this point. Is there a player that Jokic doesn't do that to? I'm not, weirdly, Karl Anthony Towns, I guess.
Rudy had Karl Anthony Towns when he's got Rudy behind him, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's a collective thing, you know? And they would be screwed against Denver without Rudy, because then it would be 48 minutes of Jokic, you know, cooking Nas and Julius, you know, who actually I think both of them like kind of admirably fight, but like, you know, you need, great point. You need Rudy Gobert to be the Nuggets, even though Jokic kind of cooks. He does not, I mean, he does. He cooks Rudy, like he cooks everybody else. But it's like, it's like about bodies, you know, a volume of bodies. It's kind of like Shaq back in the day, you know, right? Like throw in Irvin Johnson, throw in Mad Dogs, you know, throw in Oliver Miller or whatever. Like you kind of need a volume of bodies to slow him, or even, you know, be able to double him in the post a little bit with the second big coming over. Rudy's critical to that.
Yeah, my favorite Jokic story at this point is Nikhil after that game. I don't remember which game in Denver it was, but yeah. Jokic had like 50 points, right? And Nikhil's cousin was about to win 60, MVP.
60, 20, and 20. Yeah.
And Nikhil says something like, you guys know who I'm voting for, but like that guy, holy cow. It's like even the guys whose cousin, Nikhil's waiting out in the rain to go get his cousin's shoe. And even him, he's just like, I don't know. Jokic is pretty good. Obviously, you need Rudy for that. And I do kind of think they can, maybe a little bit less successfully, I do think they can run the Rudy lurking off Gordon, who might not work as well because he's shooting better. But like Randall and Nas playing the cat role, I think could be an option. Maybe not in the regular season because you're showing your cards a little bit too much, but might be worth it. But like you mentioned, apparently they might be playing Valanciunas alongside Jokic a little bit, which would definitely, now you're lurking off him, but they probably, against Minnesota, they probably wouldn't necessarily
would
do
that
as much.
Interesting one. You know, it'd be an interesting move by Denver of like, okay, well, you can't like, go ahead, like leave Valanciunas and Nas, right, or Julius to go, you know, be that low man help.
Every
or
single rebound.
On,
Valanciunas would
get
every
rebound, right? I hadn't thought about that. I mean, you could lurk, or you could probably run that team, or you know, but it's they have not had that pivot to go to a previous season.
They haven't had any good players.
Center,
like,
on the
I don't
team.
Know how to.
Yeah, right.
I don't know how to say it. Like Denver, outside of Jokic, was so goddamn bad. Like
it was.
Like, MPJ had his moments, but like I don't know. Go listen to that guy's podcast. Like, what the heck? Like. Christian Brown is great, but like their bench was so bad. Awesome. Russell Westbrook was so important for them last year. I mean, it's as fun of a like live by the Westbrook, die by the Westbrook. It like that was fun for them this year, but like they figured all of that out. They
scary.
I mean, I'm still like Bruce Brown is like they're, I mean, I get why they hype up Bruce Brown, but like also he's a minimum player. Like Tim Hardaway Jr., like, but they don't need like the Wolves version of eight starters. Like just need, like when Jokic goes off the court, you can't be the 2013 Bobcats out there. Like,
right. It was crazy, dude. I watch their games all the time and it's like, all right, need Strother to go off, you know, like, and one in every 10 games he does, but I watched enough games to see the other nine, you know, and what that looks like. And then maybe one of those nines, like Russ is good or something like that. But it was crazy. It was like, I don't know. Like, I kind of like Denver. Like, I like watching Denver play. And I think we were in this fascinating era of being able to watch Jokic. And, you know, somebody who doesn't even have, like, any sort of, I don't know, like, a stake in the thing. I'm watching Denver. It's, like, making me mad. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. How can you not help this guy? They got help. You know, they got help this year. And that's, it's, I mean, them and OKC is tough up top there. Do you have the Wolves third? Like, do you got them above Houston now?
I do. I just think the Fred VanVleet injury is just is really tough for them. I honestly think the three best teams in the NBA are in the same division. No, divisions don't matter much, but that's a fun little quirk. I mean, it's probably close between, you can take your pick between the Wolves, Cleveland, New York. I think that's probably all. It doesn't matter because like the other two teams are in the East. But yeah, I have the Wolves, especially from a regular season standpoint, I have the Wolves far closer to like Denver than the next group of teams from a regular season standpoint. When just because Jokic misses a week and they go 2-10. Or two, and not, that's not how many games he's playing a week. They like, I just think
he doesn't miss much time though.
No, he doesn't. It's crazy, but I'm not saying they're at that level regular season wise. I just think like the Wolves regular season, they are set up to be as good in the Jokic part in the playoff. I did a preliminary like top 50 players in the NBA or all time ever, and I was just like, he has three MVPs, and if they win one more title, that's obviously multiple titles. If you have that, you're one of the 10 greatest players ever. Like there's no stat. And he has plenty of other stats to back him up, but like you jump past like Shaq and Kobe and possibly Steph Curry, and you're into the Magic Johnson, Larry Bird type of area. That's who's like in that 7 to 8 range.
Yeah, it's gonna be hard for him to overcome the amount of championships that those guys have, but I think another big argument is just like, have you been watching? have you seen this dude? You know, and like, God, Steph's incredible too, and all the stuff that Steph's done for 15 years. I feel, and this is all vibes, you know, it's feel of whatever. But you remember, maybe like 10 years ago, and watching Steph was just like, oh my God, you know, it was the same thing that I feel like when I watch Jokic now. And I don't know, I'd have to think about it a little bit more, how many years of it was that. But I don't know, like, Jokic's peak and dominance of his prime could end up being as good and longer, you know, than Steph, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's where you know, people are going to point to the championship differential there. But I don't know, I always struggle with these conversations when we start bringing up, like, Magic and Bird and stuff like that. I'm like, when they were good, I wasn't alive, you know?
Yeah.
So I like doing these historical conversations about guys that, you know, I mean, both Steph and Jokic's primes are like kind of my career of covering the NBA. So I think that one I can get into, and they could have that conversation to have, but you know, God, it's just tough to, you know, Kobe or Shaq or whatever, knowing what their total championships won were. But I'm also not ruling out Denver winning like two or three more, you know. I don't think that's out of, I mean, I don't know, three sounds like a lot in today's NBA more, but I would say Jokic wins another championship, right? Like, the odds on that are over 50% that he wins another championship, right? You know, is it 25% that he wins two more? He's a fascinating character. It's funny, like, when it's such a rival of the, you know, the team we cover. But
even going back to the Jimmy days,
I love right? Yeah, true. That's where it started. It's like a decade almost now. I love some League Pass Mountain Time Nuggets games, you know, in the fall or winter or whatever. It's he's a blast to watch, and I'm curious to see. I'm getting to the point where I have Denver and Oklahoma City up like a chunk better than the Wolves. I do think I'm moving to Wolves. I've moved to Wolves over Houston, and that being close, like kind of a Wolves, Rockets, Lakers, Clippers tier there with the Wolves at the top of it. I do, to me, Oklahoma City and Denver are in a tier with a little bit of a chunk beneath them now. Until we see if this Wolves team is like, you know, does the continuity work? Do you start 16-4? Do you feel like that team from 2 years ago right away? Then okay, like, then they are Denver's class. But just estimating right now, I think Denver deserves a nudge.
Yeah, and for me personally, I think I just have the Wolves in a tier by themselves below OKC, Denver, and above those teams listed. But at this point, we're splitting hairs. I think we're pretty much on the same. And it's like a regular season. I just think the Wolves are so much built to win in the regular season, and any issues they have kind of more creep into the playoffs. But one quick topic before we wrap up, I think is the rotation. Especially if Rob is in the rotation, and if Jalen Clark and Terrence for sure is in the rotation, but like if Jalen Clark is that's 10. And I especially liked what Jalen Clark said at media day, from just like, what are you trying to do? I'm going to shoot 30 or 40% from three and guard the other team's best players. We're not taking step back threes. I mean, obviously, like, if you'll pump and go and drive and dish from there and do all that stuff, but like, it's primarily going to be defense and making open shots. I mean, they were at basically eight guys last year, eight and a half, with if we're not counting a sideline inbounds from Joe Ingles or a Josh Minot.
It's like 8.1.
5 minute party. Yeah, right. And so yeah. It just,
I don't
it
see
feels
10,
like a
dude. How do they get to 10?
Yeah,
explain it to me. Like, tell me, give me it. Like, I just this no way, man. Are they not gonna be 10? How is it gonna be 10? Like, there's 240 yeah. minutes. I don't see.
I see
it.
How
so
they
what?
Get to. Go ahead. I see how they get to 9 because you Mike's minutes will be lower. Mike will miss more games than he did last year, and obviously,
sure.
Nikhil's gone. So that like if the three players you're looking at, Shannon, Rob, and Jalen Clark. Well, one of those takes a spot. The other one takes the half role plus Mike's remaining minutes. So we'll probably call that Rob. But it's just like, yeah, that's 9. I don't, like you, where is the 10th? Where are the minutes for 10? Unless you're going to play Ant, Jaden, like those guys less. And that feels not great.
Dude, I don't even think they're going to play Mike less. I don't. Yeah. You know, what was Mike was 24 minutes a game last season? I should probably know that. I don't think they're going to play Mike less. I think he might play fewer total games, so fewer total minutes in the aggregate. But when we talk about October 22nd in Portland and the roster's all healthy, I don't know. I'm looking at the only available minutes being 22 Nikhil Alexander Walker minutes. 20, you know, because that some of that is juiced by games he started or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, I think you split that between TJ and one of Rob or Jalen. But you know, 10 minutes a night is one stint a half. You know, it's a little like 5 minutes in the second quarter, what Rob was doing. And then, you know, Rob didn't often get the second half 5 minutes. But, you know, like Finch went into all those games with the intention of like, well, you know, we'll play him for 5 minutes here and we'll play him for 5 minutes in the second half. And what happened? The second half so rarely happened there. I just think if you look at Finch's pattern of behavior, he's a trimmer as the game goes on, even if he sets it out wide with 9 or 10 guys to start. I don't know, man. I think it's 9, and I think the 9th man is getting less minutes than we think, too. More than 8.1, though. I'll take the over. The rotation will be bigger than 8.1, guys. I'm not saying over 9.1, though. I do not think so. But, you know, whatever.
A little bit, he said it. Yeah. A little bit of this is like, I think about this with like baseball pitchers, where it's like, oh no, we have 6 starting pitchers. What are we going to do? And it's just like the minute. And it's like, oh, this guy has an arm injury and he's out. Now we're down to 5 again. So a little bit of it is like that, where it's just like, it's a good problem to have. And it's just like, oh, how are we going to get these players? Oh, someone rolled their ankle. They're out for 3 games.
Right.
Okay, never mind. That fixes that. And you hope you're right. Healthy all year. And they were largely, their injuries were weird last year because they were generally healthy. But all the injuries came at like the exact same time. It's just like...
Mm-hmm.
I do remember, I think it was you, where I just kind of laughing at you a little bit, where it was like, can we get an injury? Can someone, and yeah, we're, right. like, you,
I'm serious.
Can someone get hurt so we can just change anything up? And I felt, it was probably, I don't know how long later it was, but I kind of, it was like a monkey's paw curl, and it's like everyone's hurt, and they're playing Oklahoma City with a beaten up roster, which they won one of those games, and it was just kind of like, yeah, that's pretty much it. It's just like, it would have been interesting if all those injuries were spread out, where it's just like, instead of missing everyone for 3 months, for the whole season, you were missing one guy, which is, I like this year's team as well. It's like, if you could guarantee no one would get hurt long term, but for every every month, one person and only one person would miss the entire month, you'd probably go, yeah, we'll take that. Like, that's... that's
it would have shifted the narrative so much, dude. It would have, like, if in the, you know, like 8 games into the season, Dante, like, or if he does his toe thing, then it's like, okay, here you go. You know, the 9th game of the season, Rob Dillingham's in the group. And then it's like, that's like, remember the Jared Vanderbilt Patrick Beverley year. That's like when they changed that team, you know, it completely mm-hmm. shifted its identity 10 games into the season. Cause he should, you know, it's just, I don't know. It just kind of was what it was last year. It was absolutely frustrating for us to commentate on. I think it was frustrating for Finch to navigate. And ultimately, I thought it was right, you know, the whole time. I was just mm-hmm. like, man, this would like lower the toxicity if somebody could just roll an ankle or something. But yeah. Eventually, I got my wish, I guess.
Of course, it's like not one, it's three. But last person I want to talk about is Bérenger. And just, I think, like, Jim Pete came on this pod and was very complimentary of what he's seen from Bérenger behind the scenes and in front of scenes. And similar to your, if we're struggling to get Jalen or Rob in this rotation, certainly a healthy rotation is going to struggle to fit in Bérenger. But do you think that there's a point later in the season, like if, let's just say one big goes down or two big, or a big and a wing goes down, do you think that, like, Bérenger could be ready to play as soon as this season, or is it going to be more of an Iowa season for him?
I mean, transparently, I don't know. I think people who have been around the team, like Jim, who you said you had on, you know, he's actually, you know, been at the facility and, you know, watching him and, you know, talking to people there about what they've seen from Bérenger. And I, you know, I've done some of that, and I think he's very much stood out as, you know, being explosive and a fun lob threat and all those things for them. You know, he's been here for a while, and, you know, all these guys have been here for a while. So I think it's like looked really good. He's looked really good in open runs. I would say he looks bigger than he did at summer league. To my eye test, like from a physical standpoint, I think he's been on an NBA lifting program now for 3 months or whatever. And he's also like, still like growing up as like a kid, young man in a way too, mm-hmm. that you're like naturally going to put some on. I'm until told or indicated otherwise, I'm thinking about Bérenger as Garza, which we think of Garza mostly in the short term. No, obviously there's a vision for him beyond that, but you're talking about like this season or first game he plays in non-garbage minutes. I think will be like the first games that Luka played in, or the games that Luka would play in last year, where it's like, oh, out a big body or two, and it's a team that you feel comfortable personnel-wise of putting him out there. And even with Luka, like, there was times where they just were forced to play him, again, non-garbage minutes, against teams that were going to spread him and hurt him defensively. And they still, you know, like, Luka played more non-garbage time minutes than I think, right? That is maybe the, mm-hmm. the perception of it. So I think that's like, that's a non-zero role to me for Bérenger. And given the how I was just talking about struggling to see how you get to 10, I very much struggle to see how you get to 11, which I think Bérenger sits at, without an injury, and specifically an injury to a big. But even then, let's, you know, knock on wood, Nas or Julius Randle roll their ankle the first couple weeks. I think the big you see most, the new big you see most, is Jaden sliding up to the four. I think that might be as big of a reason for Bérenger not getting minutes this season. If he doesn't, again, I don't know. Than anything, just because I think they, you know, Jaden's gotten a little bigger and stronger himself, and I think is ready to. Mm-hmm. I think they're ready to play him at the four some. As we talked about the injured time last year when guys were hurt, it was Nas at the five, Jaden at the four. What was that, 5-10 games? That was the starting lineup there in January, February. So it's very hard for me to see a Bérenger path, even though he's probably exceeded their early expectations, and they love him. But
yeah,
they loved Rob Dillingham last year too, you know. Some of it just is what it is.
Yeah. And I agree that it's going to be a project with him. I whispered to John after his presser and was just like, it's going to be fun to see his language grow as he hasn't been speaking totally. English that long.
It's already grown.
It's going to be fun. Mm-hmm. From draft night. It's going to be fun in 2-4 years when he's fairly close to fluent, and it seemed like, remember that first media day or that draft night where he was struggling for every word as we would if we were speaking a second language? Like, yeah, it's going to be fun to see. I'm as high in his long-term potential, I think, as anyone, and especially just seeing him in summer league. But looking around the league, I will say,
and what a cool future pivot for him. Oh, sorry, I cut you off. But like, it opens up this whole like really interesting, different way to have a center, you know, down the line.
Yep.
A faster, you know, not just a drop coverage center like Rudy. I mean, it's extremely unlikely that Yoan Berenguer ever becomes as good of a defensive center as Rudy Gobert, right? But he could totally become a more diverse defensive center than Rudy, and definitely a more diverse and impactful offensive player too. It opens up a really cool future reality, I think, for the quote unquote second timeline. Sorry, what were you saying?
Yeah, I was just, I see people like putting Boston as like, oh, a sleeper in the East. And I'm just kind of like, they're relying on Luka Garza a lot. Like, they traded everyone. It's not even a slight to Luka. Like, I honestly, like, I think he can kind of be a rotation player in this league. Maybe not, like, I don't know. But, like, he's like their starter, or he's going to play like 30 minutes. Like, and they traded away everyone. Like, I'm not trying to crap on Boston because, like, it sucks that, like, their season and their whole team got traded away aside for Tatum and Brown and Derek White. But, like, I would caution Boston fans. And, like, they're especially like, well, Tatum's going to be back. And I'm just like, why?
Like, sure.
Like, just, I'm not saying you got to tank it out. Maybe the season ends up going that way for them. But it's just like, you're going to be in the play-in tournament. Maybe you'll make the playoffs. There's no need to bring Tatum back for that sort of team. But I think what's interesting with Berenguer and Gobert is that I think people are just so, myself included, so amped to like compare them. And I think their games are very different. The way they find defensive value is very different. Berenguer is going to be quicker, is going to be more that type of defender. He's obviously going to have rim protection in his arsenal, but like, he's not going to be the greatest rim protector of this generation. That's what Rudy is. Like, we kind of got to remind ourselves, Rudy's a unicorn special player. And obviously we already talked about his warts, part of his game, but like, they're going to be different. And it's kind of like, you ask him, well, what have you learned from Rudy? And I'm certain they are obviously helping them, but it kind of feels like there's a little bit of like, not pushback, but like, yeah, I'm learning from Rudy. I'm learning from all these guys. Like, I almost feel like from Rudy's going to come from like, you're a French kid moving to America, that type of stuff. Here's how to go from French to English. And maybe even he'll learn from Rudy as much as anyone. It won't be as much on the court. Does my logic track there?
Yeah, no, I get that. It's more of the like personal stuff, you know, having a similar like literal background of, you know, where they come from, and Rudy experienced the whole acclimation process. And frankly, that might be just as valuable and important to him as getting good like tips on how to play two and drop coverage, you know. But to your point, Berenguer, I think, is going to be his own type of player. He isn't like, he might get a lot of blocks, and I wouldn't, like, you know, if it's per 36 minutes, maybe even has more blocks than Rudy next season, right? In 10 games or something like that. He has a 5 block game or something like that. But he is going to be an overzealous shot blocker, which means he is going to foul. He is going to get out of position. He's going to be pump faked, you know, for players to draw fouls. And you know who doesn't let like any of that ever happen? Rudy. And that's why he's the best rim protector. And that's why he's the best backline, or has been the best backline center guy to have there. It's, I don't know. Berenguer is more of like a quick speed taking, is my read on it now, at least. I don't know exactly. But quick foot speed, taking up space, quick off the ground, can go get a shot block anywhere. And I think, honestly, where I'm most interested to see him, or where I think he might be most impactful, is as a rolling lob threat around the basket. Everything I've heard is he has incredible hands, which we know there's going to be a, if that's true, that's going to be a big delta between him and Rudy. You know, it just is what it is. But there, I think there's going to be a gigantic delta between the defensive impact of Rudy Gobert and Yohan Berenguer, obviously this season, and probably for the entirety of their careers. And that's not to say Berenguer can't become a good, right? Like I said, diverse coverage type of five. But yeah, there'll be a day that comes where Rudy Gobert is no longer on this team. We're going to be like, why the hell does every team score 120 points? You know, like, it's like, it's going to happen, you know, even if Berenguer is good. Like, Rudy is a depressant. He's a deterrent in unprecedented ways in the NBA. So, I don't know. Well, I'm still excited about the alternate path with Berenguer whenever that time comes. But yes, to your point, I think very different.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's where we're going to wrap it up. I really appreciate, Dane, you coming on. What do you got to, if anything, to plug with your stuff?
Yeah, you know, same old deal with me. We're doing more shows this year. People don't, you know who I am. I've, you know, covered the Wolves for a long time, and now I'm doing it in podcast form exclusively, and I have all the beat reporters and columnists that are, you know, travel to the games and are at all the practices and stuff from the newspapers, and Brett Robson from MinPost joined me. But yeah, we're doing near daily shows. I'm trying to do pretty much Monday through Friday during the season this year, and it's a lot of conversations like this one with Ryan, where, you know, Ryan's there a ton too, and we're always doing what we were talking about, right? Of like, okay, we have our inherent biases, we have our thoughts of it, and what I try to do with my show is like scrape those up against what I'm hearing from the players and coaches, but also from other smart people like yourself and Britt and Kyle and Chris and Jace and all them too, because it's a there's no right way to look at any of this stuff, right? None of us bat 1,000%, and sometimes it's good to, you know, sharpen your ideas off of other people's ideas. So that's kind of the idea behind my show. And yeah, I appreciate you having me. And we'll do it again sometime this year, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll shout out your episode with Alan Horton. I think it probably pairs well with me and Leo talking with Jim. So you get both angles of the new Timberwolves broadcast. Obviously, Grady will be in the booth as well this season. So I'll shout out that episode specifically and all your training camp stuff this week. But yeah, thank you. Dane, I'm Ryan. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Go Wolves!